Today is Thursday, July 30th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. The number of COVID-19 cases in Australia continues to surge.
We declared yesterday Greater Sydney a hotspot that will take effect from 1 a.m. Saturday.
Plus, what are the effects of the pandemic on the children of frontline workers?
Anxiety about being sick, anxiety about their parents being at risk, and anxiety for themselves.
We'll have these stories and more next. India's health ministry on Thursday morning reported 775 new deaths due to COVID-19 and 52,123 new positive cases in the past 24 hours. This is the highest single-day number of fresh COVID-19 cases in the country so far and takes the number of deaths to just under 35,000 and the total number of cases to almost 1.6 million. But the government did share some good news. According to ministry officials, more than a million people have been discharged from hospitals after showing improvement. Globally, the total number of COVID-19 cases now tops 17 million, with nearly 670,000 deaths, and the United States is leading the world in both categories. With more than 4.4 million total confirmed cases, the U.S. reached another milestone in the coronavirus pandemic Wednesday, when it passed 150,000 deaths, according to data collected by Johns Hopkins University. Australia's COVID-19 crisis is intensifying, with a record 723 new infections reported in the state of Victoria in the past day and 13 deaths. Some internal borders in eastern Australia are also closed again in a bid to stop the spread of the virus. Phil Mercer reports Australia has about 15,500 confirmed coronavirus infections, and more than 175 people have died.
This is Australia's deadliest day of the pandemic so far. Victoria, the nation's second most populous state, has recorded more than 720 new infections and 13 deaths in the past 24 hours. These are new daily records. Victoria State Premier Daniel Andrews.
I'm saddened to have to report that the total number of people who have died because of this global pandemic in Victoria is now 105. That is 13 additional fatalities. Three men and three women in their 70s. Three men and two women in their 80s. And two men in their 90s. We send our condolences, our best wishes, our thoughts and prayers to those families. This will be incredibly challenging.
Specialist teams usually sent to disaster zones overseas are starting work in Victoria's aged care homes, where serious outbreaks have been reported. Australia's Federal Health Minister Greg Hunt has described the assistance teams as the special forces of the medical world. The military is also part of the contact tracing effort, aimed at helping to ensure patients who test positive isolate themselves. The Victorian state capital, Melbourne, was placed into a six-week lockdown for a second time earlier this month. 5 million people are subject to stay-at-home orders. They can leave only for essential tasks, and masks are mandatory when they do so. Residents from Sydney, which has several COVID-19 clusters, will soon be banned from travelling to Queensland. Queensland State Premier Anastasia Palaszczuk.
We declared yesterday Greater Sydney a hotspot that will take effect from 1 a.m. Saturday. That is definitely the right decision that we have made to protect Queensland and Queenslanders' health.
Australia's international borders were closed to foreign travellers in March and are likely to stay shut into next year. Australian citizens returning home face a mandatory 14 days in hotel quarantine. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Nearly a half year into the COVID-19 pandemic, its impact on the mental health of children remains an open question. To find out more about the fears many children of frontline workers face and what can be done to protect their mental health, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke by Zoom with Janine Dominguez, a clinical psychologist in the Anxiety Disorder Center at the Child Mind Institute in New York. She began by emphasizing the unusual stresses many are experiencing due to the pandemic.
they're having to think about it and be faced with it much more often than children of non-frontline workers. And so anxiety about being sick, anxiety about their parents being at risk, and anxiety for themselves too. And unfortunately, given how we protect one another from the virus, children aren't with parents who might be at the front line, or they might have to distance and isolate from them. That can also increase anxiety as well. So they're just at a greater risk for mental health difficulties since they're faced with the real fear of their parents potentially dying.
So there's sort of a double whammy for kids of frontline workers. They've got the everyday fear, but they also can't really touch or be in physical contact with their parents many times.
Yeah, I think both. Not being able to have typical or normal attachment, whether it's hugging a parent, cuddling with a parent, and also being faced with having to stay safe because their parents are frontline workers, increases anxiety.
Older kids can get online and understand the situation somewhat, but what about much younger kids?
Younger children are only going to know what parents are telling them. And so for them, it is going to be reiterating the story about germs, and this is how we're keeping safe, and simplifying it to their language. And it really is about still getting that comfort from another guardian that's home with them, and who's going to be taking care of them, and who's going to be the attachment figure currently in their life. That's really important for children to know too. And I would also say that it has to be paired with something that helps a child feel in control and connected to their parents. You're really trying to establish some predictability and routine, whether that means scheduled phone calls to keep in touch, letters, especially when it's feeling very uncertain and not knowing when this is going to end.
At what age do kids generally begin to understand the larger picture and self-soothe because of that?
Well, what we know developmentally is around the age of 8, metacognition kicks in, and being able to engage in positive self-talk at that age, being able to label what they're feeling and putting things in place to help turn down that intensity, or it might be more behavioral. So things that they can do in the moment, but having a dialogue and an open dialogue at any age is incredibly important. But rooting them in what their parents are doing to keep safe as well. That way, not only is the narrative about them at risk, but also about how they're keeping safe.
What about parents simply listening to their children without trying to convince them or reassure them of anything, just so their children feel heard?
Absolutely. Yes. Sitting with a child, hearing how they feel and just reflecting that back gives them the space to know that it's okay to feel what they're feeling. That in and of itself is grounding. It also is creating an attachment and a connection with an adult figure in their life. Validating that fear, saying, I hear you and you're right. The virus is real and I can potentially get sick at work, and you want to pair that with how at work, these are all the things that we do in order to keep clean, stay sanitized. We wear all these protective things in order to stay safe, and really honestly grounding them in what we know scientists and doctors are doing and what we know to do. And so while it feels like we can't control anything, we can.
We'll all do our best, right?
Yeah, we'll do our best and we'll get through it together.
Janine Dominguez is a clinical psychologist in the Anxiety Disorder Center at the Child Mind Institute in New York, as well as a child and family psychotherapist. She was speaking to VOA's Adam Phillips. The U.S. economy contracted at its steepest pace since the Great Depression in the second quarter as the COVID-19 pandemic shattered consumer and business spending. And a nascent recovery is under threat from a resurgence in new cases of coronavirus. Gross domestic product collapsed at a 32.9% annualized rate last quarter, the deepest decline in output since the government started keeping records in 1947, according to the Commerce Department. The drop in GDP was more than triple the previous all-time decline of 10% in the second quarter of 1958. The economy contracted at a 5% pace in the first quarter. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. The Trump administration on Wednesday announced an expanded effort to assist local law enforcement in U.S. cities that have seen spikes in violent crime. At the same time, a deal was announced to withdraw federal forces from the city of Portland, Oregon, where protests for racial injustice have entered a third month. VOA's Carolyn Pursuti reports on the controversy over sending federal forces to help police American cities.
More than 60 nights of protests in Portland demanding racial justice. More recently, an additional complaint from the group.
The feds have to get out of town. They've done nothing but escalate.
For days, officers fired tear gas and other devices, hoping to disperse angry protesters at a federal courthouse. The crowd responded by shooting fireworks at the officers.
These here are rubber bullets.
Brian says he collected this non-lethal ammunition after federal officers fired on the protesters.
What they're doing, absolutely against the United States Constitution.
Civil liberty groups have sued to stop federal police actions on American streets. The Constitution does leave policing to cities and states, but federal officials have the authority to protect federal buildings and property, which protesters in Portland have defaced. On Tuesday, U.S. Attorney General William Barr testified before Congress.
Since when is it okay to try to burn down a federal court?
Are we American? Are we American?
For the past week, a line of women known as the Wall of Moms stood between federal officers and protesters. Bev Barnum started the movement through social media and has seen other groups join the effort.
What the protesters are telling us is that we make them feel safer. That having a wall of moms and a wall of dads and a wall of vets makes them feel like their voices can actually be heard.
On Wednesday, some progress was made on a compromise. The Trump administration and the city of Portland agreed that Oregon State Police will take over the protection of federal buildings and that most of the federal officers will leave. But from President Donald Trump, a warning.
We told the governor, we told the mayor, secure your city. If they don't secure their city soon, we have no choice. We're going to have to go in and clean it out.
Run!
In Portland, the departure of federal agents could diffuse the city's most immediate tensions. But demonstrators in cities across America say the quest for racial justice will continue. Carolyn Pursuti, VOA News.
Hong Kong's government said on Thursday that 12 opposition candidates in an upcoming election for seats in the city's legislature have been disqualified and that more could face a similar decision in the near term. Civic Party Chairman Alan Leong told reporters the government disqualified people it does not want to see in the next session of the Legislative Council. And disqualified politician Dennis Kwok added,
"When the national security law was passed, I said that one country, two system is finished. Make no mistake about it. And I think today we are seeing the results of the relentless oppression that this regime is starting, not only just to take away the basic fundamental rights and freedom that was once enjoyed by all Hong Kong people under the basic law as promised under the Sino-British Joint Declaration, but they are also trying to drive fear and oppression into our hearts. And this, we must not let them succeed."
The government said advocating for self-determination, soliciting intervention by foreign governments, or expressing an objection in principle to the new national security law were behaviors that could not genuinely uphold the city's mini-constitution or basic law. Prominent pro-democracy activist Joshua Wong confirmed on social media that he was also among the 12 disqualified. The government denied that there was any political censorship or restriction of freedom of speech in the matter. And this week, Human Rights Watch wrote that, quote, "Hong Kong authorities have rapidly begun to apply the new national security law to prosecute peaceful speech, curtail academic freedom, and generate a chilling effect on fundamental freedoms in the city," end quote. I asked their senior researcher, Maya Wong, to explain.
It's the fact that many kind of previously allowed activities and speech are now being unlawful. For example, organizing a democratic primary, which is essentially a poll, is now a violation of the national security law. And or the fact that saying liberate Hong Kong, revolution of our times, is also illegal, just saying so. Because people in Hong Kong never had to wonder what the red line was. There was no red line, unless obviously you break the law.
You bring up the political process. You know, we saw some pro-democracy and pro-self-determination individuals be elected to the Legislative Council a while back, and then they were disqualified because of the way that they interacted with the oath. And the NSL, you know, really makes it clear the way it's written is that if you do anything to perpetuate the notion that Hong Kong should be separate than China, that runs afoul with it. But you also mentioned that holding primaries could run afoul with it, and that was something that Carrie Lam did mention when the pro-democracy candidates were holding their polling not too long ago, but that did go through recently.
Yeah. Well, I think the way in which the Chinese government often deals with a sense of dissent in regions like Hong Kong, Tibet, and Xinjiang is to focus on the elements of pro-independence sentiments in the population, but at the same time using those sentiments as an excuse to crack down on freedoms and to repress the population. So what you do see is the fact that national security law and a lot of the legal enforcement, even prior to it, has led to the criminalization of a number of leaders in various political parties, from very establishment parties like the Democratic Party to, you know, like you said, the pro-independence groups like now Student Localism, are now facing charges for peaceful activities. So it is not just that this law is not just used against people or leaders of groups that promote independence, but really are used to repress kind of any push for democratic governance. However, I also think that the government has been concerned about international pushback, and that's why, you know, even though it intimidated the people and went to harass the people who organized this democratic primary, at the end it did allow it to go through.
I also want to ask you as to, you know, you touched on why the government may be expanding its powers there, taking a look at what's happening in mainland China, especially in Xinjiang with the Uyghur population. Has the international community not done enough to hold human rights up high enough for China not to enact policies on the mainland? And now that they're extending them to, you know, Hong Kong, which, you know, for, you know, all this time has operated under the one country, two systems policy.
Well, I think it's I almost want to laugh because, you know, of course, we have spent all those years telling many governments to take actions to China, to the Chinese government's increasing aggression, cracking down on human rights domestically. And now these kind of violations are expanding essentially across the border, since, you know, Hong Kong is in some ways a city that belongs in, well, international, is an international city. But also you see kind of the chilling of freedom of expression by Chinese dissidents living abroad. So, yes, no, the international community has not acted adequately for the last 2 decades or so over the Chinese government's behavior. And the increasing violations in Xinjiang and now in Hong Kong are symptoms of a Chinese government that just don't think they will be held accountable for any of the actions, whether it's about imprisoning or detaining a million Turkic Muslims unlawfully, or just kind of take away people's freedoms in Hong Kong overnight.
Maya Wong is the senior China researcher for Human Rights Watch. Former Taiwanese President Lee Teng-hui, who brought direct elections and other democratic changes despite missile launches and other fierce saber-rattling by China, has died at the age of 97. Li strove to create a separate, non-Chinese identity for Taiwan, angering not only China, which considers the island part of its territory, but also members of its Nationalist Party, who hoped to return victorious to the mainland. He was president from 1988 to 2000. Google and Facebook took particularly sharp jabs for alleged abuse of their market power from Democrats and Republicans on Wednesday in a much-anticipated congressional hearing that put four of America's most prominent tech CEOs in the hot seat. Reuters' Chris Dingham has the details.
The chief executives of America's largest tech firms, Apple, Amazon, Google, and Facebook, faced harsh criticism on Wednesday from lawmakers who accused them of abusing their market dominance.
Simply put, they have too much power.
Most Republicans concentrated on claims their platforms censor right-wing voices.
Big tech's out to get conservatives.
But both sides of the aisle appeared to agree that the four tech titans engaged in unfair business practices. Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg faced some of the toughest questions on Wednesday, as lawmakers, including Representative Pramila Jayapal, came armed with damaging internal emails about the company's acquisitions, including its 2012 purchase of Instagram.
Has Facebook ever threatened to clone the products of another company while also attempting to acquire that company?
Congresswoman, not that I recall.
Google's Sundar Pichai fielded the most questions on Wednesday and was accused by Democratic chair of the House Antitrust Committee David Cicilline of stealing.
Why does Google steal content from honest businesses?
Mr. Chairman, with respect, I disagree with that characterization.
Cicilline went after Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos, too.
We called it Amazon heroin.
Citing a third-party seller who said the e-commerce giant, quote, strings you along until it crushes you.
Chris Dingham reports for Reuters News. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and good night.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Sub-Saharan Africa's population is growing by leaps and bounds. Some 60% of Africans are under 25 years old. And a decade from now, there will be about 320 million Africans between the ages of 15 and 24. Most of these young people will need jobs. By some estimates, Africa will need 18 million new jobs per year for the next 20 years. This is where Prosper Africa comes in. Announced in December 2018, this initiative aims to dramatically increase two-way trade and investment between the United States and Africa, according to USAID's Acting Assistant Administrator for Africa, Chris Maloney.
We want to do that because that's where job-creating, long-term, self-sustaining economic growth comes from.
This is where the three objectives of Prosper Africa come into play, said Mr. Maloney.
So the first thing that Prosper Africa is doing is created a coordinated one-stop shop so that both African and U.S. investors have a simple one-stop shop to go to help figure out, hey, I have this idea, I have this investment opportunity, how can you help me make it happen?
It's that simple, but incredibly important, said Acting Assistant Administrator Maloney. The second objective is to facilitate commercial engagement between the United States and African countries. To fulfill all aspects of Prosper Africa, every U.S. embassy in Africa has an interagency team of people called the Deal Team, who work with both the U.S. and the host country's private sector to identify exciting business opportunities.
These deal teams can help unpack the mystery of operating in a given country. The third objective, the third piece of what Prosper Africa does, is really working hard to foster a level playing field when it comes to trade and investment across Africa. So that's a lot of policy and technical support both to governments and to civil society to help advocate for policies that will make doing business easier.
So at the end of the day, it's that one-stop shop, said Acting Assistant Administrator Maloney. It's those deal teams and its trade and investment policy work. Those are three pieces which together will ensure that we get the Prosper Africa Initiative right. We're very hopeful that we'll be able to really spur more trade between Africa and the United States.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.